I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Oliver.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
All right, episode one, season one of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by Redcon One, Six Pack Bags, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to the first episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm your host, John Hansen, and I am very excited to be hosting my first Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And like the name of the podcast says, we are going to be talking about the legendary years of bodybuilding, the golden age of bodybuilding from the 1960s to the 1990s. For those of you who have been following me on YouTube, you may have seen some of my Bodybuilding Legends interviews where I've done extensive interviews with some of the legends of bodybuilding like Boyer Coe and Bill Grant, Mike Katz, Sean Ray, Lee Haney, Rich Gaspari. I've got like 22 video interviews up right now. And we have a new website at thebodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And I've got all those interviews on there. So we are now starting a weekly podcast on the show. And we're going to talk about different topics related to the classic era of bodybuilding. And season one of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is going to be all about the movie Pumping Iron, which this is the 40th anniversary of the movie Pumping Iron. It was released in January of 1977. It was a very iconic movie, probably the best documentary ever made about bodybuilding. It was inspiring people to start working out 40 years ago, and it's still inspiring them today to work out. It's a great movie. It really introduced Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno to the bodybuilding public, and it started their entertainment careers. So it's a great movie, and we're going to talk about it. I was actually in the theater back in 1977 to see the movie. And so we've got some great guests in this season one of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We're going to talk to a couple of the bodybuilders that were actually in the movie, including Bill Grant, Roger Callard, and Mike Katz. And we're going to talk to an IFBB judge, Roger Schwab, who was around during the 1970s. And he actually walked in with Arnold in that scene where Arnold walked into Gold's Gym and Pumping Iron. And we're going to talk to the writer of the book, Pumping Iron, Charles Gaines. But today, on episode number one, we're going to talk to author Randy Roach. Randy is the author of the book Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, and it's actually a three-volume set. Volume one came out in like 2008. It was a really big book, over 500 pages. And Randy covers basically the whole history of bodybuilding in his books Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. He starts off in the 1800s talking about how bodybuilding got started and some of the bodybuilders who really started the sport off, including Eugene Sandow. And then in volume two, which is the book we're going to be talking about today, that came out in 2011. That was an even bigger book, almost 700 pages. And Randy's got a couple chapters in there about the movie Pumping Iron. So he talked to Charles Gaines and George Butler for his book. And he's got some great information about the book Pumping Iron and about the movie Pumping Iron. And we're specifically going to talk about the movie Pumping Iron because Randy's going to talk about several bodybuilders who were around during that time who could have been in the movie, and it really would have made a different type of movie if these guys would have been in it, but they weren't involved in the movie. And we're also going to talk about what happened with Serge Nubre, because Serge Nubre, as you remember, took second to Arnold Schwarzenegger at the 1975 Mr. Olympia, but he was only featured for a small part in the movie, and he said that he should have been featured in it more. So we're going to talk to Randy about that. We're going to talk to Randy about the difficulties that Charles Gaines and George Butler had in getting the book made, and then the difficulties that George Butler had getting the movie made. So we got a really fascinating interview with Randy Roach. If you don't know anything about Randy, he's actually blind. He's visually impaired. So the fact that Randy was able to do these massive volumes, three books, is really amazing. And book three, which I didn't talk about, was about the 1980 and 1981 Mr. Olympias. And actually, I was a big part of that book because he had me talk about the 1981 Mr. Olympia that I was at. So he used me pretty extensively in book one, volume three, because it was a smaller edition of volume three, and he's going to be coming out with more books of volume three. So anyways, we're going to talk to Randy about the movie Pumping Iron today. And before we get to that, I really want to thank our sponsors for sponsoring this first podcast. First of all, I want to thank Redcon One. My friend Aaron Singerman owns Redcon One, and Aaron was kind enough to sponsor the show. Now, everyone who wants to be a champion, everyone who wants to be the best, but at Redcon 1, they believe in working hard at achieving your goals. Whether it's to kill it in the gym or run a six-minute mile, Redcon 1 has something for those willing to put in the work. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout, Total War, is the perfect companion to your workout to give you the extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then you can fuel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. It's the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs. And the carbs are from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also includes 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try their very best sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon 1, the highest state of readiness. And for this show, you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get a 15% discount off your order. We're also brought to you by Six Pack Bags. Six Pack Fitness creates premium iconic meal management bags, healthy competitor-friendly hot sauces, and accessories geared toward everyone, from the serious athlete, bodybuilder, CrossFit, or fitness enthusiast. They provide stylish and innovative solutions for those who live active, healthy lifestyles. And their products are designed to keep everyone organized and prepared so they can focus on their fitness goals, training hard, eating right, and staying healthy. Check them out at sixpackbags.com and use the promo code LEGENDS10 to receive 10% off your total purchase. My friend John Cancellino gave me one of these six-pack bags, and I really love it. It's great for if you're on the road and you need to bring your meals with you, whether it's for the day or whether you're going for a weekend or whatever. You got containers where you can make all your meals. You can put your protein drinks in there, water, your supplements, utensils, everything. It's really awesome. So check them out at sixpackbags.com. We're also brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. Do you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential? Then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They have a wide range of services that ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but they're comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. They have very competitive pricing along with quality products and services, and those are just a few of the additional reasons to give them a try. Give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. And they can service anybody throughout the whole United States, so you don't even have to be in Florida. Go to opeshealth.org, that's opeshealth.org, or call them at 813-906-6737 and use the promotion code LEGEND for a free consultation and 20% off all packages. And finally, last but not least, we are brought to you by Old School Labs. Old School Labs makes uncompromisingly premium supplements, and Old School Labs draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Brands is the brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with it, and it is the brand that I personally used to win the Masters Natural Olympia a few years ago. Old School Labs is giving you 12% off your purchase. Just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at checkout. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. So thank you to all my sponsors, Redcon 1, Six Pack Bags, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Old School Labs for sponsoring their first episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, let's get to our interview with Randy Roach, the author of Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. We're going to talk about the movie Pumping Iron. Here it is. All right, my guest this week is Mr. Randy Roach, and Randy has written a series of books called Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. He has now, I think, volume 1, 2, and 3, and we're going to talk to Randy today about the movie Pumping Iron, since this is the 40th anniversary this year. It came out in 1977, and Randy talks pretty extensively about both the book and the movie Pumping Iron in his volume 2 of Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. So, Randy, it's great to have you on the show. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me on, John. Like I said, it was about 7-8 years since I was on your show before.
Yeah, I had that Natural Bodybuilding radio show, I think back in 2009, 2010, and I think we had you on right after the Volume 1 came out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, time goes by, huh?
Certainly does.
Well, Randy, before we start talking about pumping iron, tell us what's going on with Muscle Smoke and Mirrors, because I know you came out with two huge volumes, volume one and two, and then volume three was sort of a smaller volume, and you were going to come out, I think, a little bit, you're going to do smaller books, right, so you can bring them out more often instead of putting in such a big book?
Well, I don't know about more often. It's the fact that one of the criticisms of the books, first two, that the size. And I understood, like, a 700-page book, it can be intimidating. But so I thought, well, I would do volume three. I wasn't sure how far I was even going to go with it. So I said, well, I got a lot of information already drafted. Some of the information volume three drafted back, 8 years. In fact, the prologue for volume three, book one, was done close to 6 years ago. I started it, and then I finished it up there, because the book at first was going to be one book, two books, three books. It just kept growing and growing and growing. So I thought I would just break it up. And the first one of the 1980s, it was a great start with the first, the 1980 and 81 Mr. Olympia, which you had a really significant part in that first book because of your firsthand information. And I thought you had great analysis of 1981 Mr. Olympia. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
But I don't know when I'm going to do it. For sure I'm going to do one more, volume two. I have a lot of information on the women. It's like I said, I drafted the women up probably 7 years ago. And then I have a lot of good information between the quirky relationship between Wayne D'Amelio and the Wheeler brothers. And it's outrageous. Like, I mean, it's some of the most people, I don't think, have a clue what was going on behind the scenes between Wayne D'Amelio and Ben and Joe Wheeler. And that story, I think, really needs to be told. It's kind of coming up to probably culminate just that bodybuilding story with what's going on right now with the lawsuits and the with the NSL and the and the NPC and all that stuff going on. So I am writing another book right now. I'm a bit interested in nutrition, and I put an ebook out called Food Intelligence. It's mostly based on a 10-part raw food series I did. But right now I'm writing one on, I don't have a title for you, but it's going to be a bigger book than about 200-300 pages on vegan. Arnold's got inspired by Arnold's request for us to become vegetarians at the 2015 Paris Climate Conference. And I did three podcasts, but turn in a book. It's going to be a lot of politics in this book. I draft a lot of politics as it surrounds nutrition through the 20th century, and this is the book that's going into. So I'm hoping to have that one out this year. Then I'll probably head back to book two of volume three for Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start our discussion about pumping iron, because, like I said, in volume two, you've got a lot of information on there. In fact, I've been in bodybuilding for now 40 years, and you had some stuff in here that I didn't even know about, so it was pretty wild how you get some of this inside information. But before we talk about...
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead, Jeremy.
No, I was going to say, I was shocked too with something when I was researching, because I didn't know that. you think you've been around, you think you know everything, and all of a sudden you're humbled, right? I didn't know that at all.
Yeah.
So I was lucky to have George and Charles cooperate with me. That was very helpful.
Oh, so you did talk to both Charles Gaines and George Butler for the book, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely, to get that information. And I got even Jerome Gary and a couple others, because I was lucky, because Charles, I heard, didn't do any more interviews. And Wayne D'Amelio got me in touch with George Butler. George Butler liked what I was doing, and George convinced Charles to speak, and Charles is a good guy. So they liked the first one, so they cooperated with book three. And somewhat like in the next book is the Pumping Iron the Women, right? When my women's chapter, I have the second Pumping Iron series. I have that all drafted up. But yeah, they were great to speak to.
Well, before we start talking about the movie, let's talk about the book Pumping Iron. And some of the newcomers to bodybuilding today may not realize that there was even a book before there was a movie. But they started, Charles and George Butler got really started together back in 1972 when they were hired to write an article for Sports Illustrated about bodybuilding. And this was kind of the coming out of bodybuilding into the public eye, right?
Yeah, it was early 70s. Bodybuilding was started. Arnold Schwarzenegger just appeared on TV probably around 1971, maybe spring of 71, they aired the ABC Wide World of Sports, had the 1970 Mr. World and in the World Weightlifting Championships. And I actually watched that when I was a kid when that came out. That's the first time I saw for Sergio and Arnold on TV. I'd seen Dave Draper before. But bodybuilding was starting to come into the public eye. And, you know, with Arthur Jones with his Nautilus, you know, things and the health, people were becoming more health conscious. Things were starting to pick up. And Charles Gaines and George Butler came around just at the right time as well. Mm-hmm. Charles was the writer. He was he got the offer from from Sports Illustrated. George was the photographer where they headed off in the, I think July of 72 at the IFBB Mr. East Coast. They would have just missed the 1972 AAU Mr. America because that was my first question. Why did they pick the IFBB as opposed to the AAU? In terms of because they were covering an amateur sport, but they had missed the Mr. America, so they caught the IBB Mr. East Coast in Holyoke, Massachusetts. So and it was quite a popular. It was cutting some fancy figures. I think was the name of the article.
Yeah.
It came out on July 10th, 1972 issue of Sports Illustrated, and it actually went over quite well. That Charles was working then. We Magazine at the time, and they wanted an article on bodybuilding. And George went along with him to in the fall to the Mr. America, Mr. World, I don't think, and what else they had? That show, IFBB, in I think, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn
Academy. Yeah, that's where he met Arnold. That's where they first met Arnold and had lunch with Arnold. Because I was always curious, why didn't they follow Arnold to Essen, Germany to cover the Olympia? Why did they go off to Baghdad, Iraq and cover the Mr. Universe show?
Right.
And we can see why that at that time, the Mr. Olympia, it just wasn't much of a show. It wasn't as popular as compared to the Mr. Universe in Iraq was a major extravaganza, with a lot of respect. And a huge turnout where, over in 1971, Arnold competed uncontested for the Mr. Olympia. Like, he just, the NABBA drew most of those guys that year. That was the year that Sergio went against Reg Park and Bill Pearl, right? So it showed you that the IFBB did not have the drawing power. It was still the NABBA. Mr. Universe had the drawing power in 1971. So I kind of realized then, okay, that's why George and Charles decided to go to Iraq and cover the Mr. Universe World Championships in 1972. It was between that September Mr. America, Mr. World show. Ed Corney had won. That's Ed Corney and Mike Katz. Mm-hmm. I believe Ken Waller was supposed to go too, but he became sick or something like that. But so it was just Mike Katz, Ed Corney, and Tom Minicello that went over. But sometime between that September show and the Mr. Universe, they had decided they were going to make a book, and they got a down payment, for money for Doubleday Publishing, where Charles had, I think, known the publisher there because he had written his novel, Stay Hungry. Stay Hungry was a novel before it became a movie.
Right.
Because there was a lot of overlap between those movies, Pumping Iron and Stay Hungry.
So why did they go to the 1972 Mr. America? Because they covered the Mr. East Coast in the summer, and that was for Sports Illustrated. But were they just interested in bodybuilding at the time?
Yeah, Charles would then had a request from We Magazine.
Oh, okay.
To go and cover another show, and then George went there representing the Village Voice as the photographer, and so they went to the Brooklyn Academy. Arnold and Franco were there as guest posers.
Right.
Because
and that was like 2 weeks before the Mr. Olympia, right? In Essen, Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were just there, I guess, posing. And that's where they had breakfast. Franco and Arnold had breakfast with Charles and George. And they got to meet Arnold. They were, pretty charmed with Arnold. They thought he had, had potential and stuff. But they're actually, they liked Mike Katz quite a bit, too, and Ed Corney. Like Charles said, they were fascinated with those guys. Mike was just enormous at that time as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just a big guy, and so they liked his personality. So they went off to Iraq and Baghdad. I thought it would have been interesting had Charles and George as outside journalist, gone to Essen, Germany, and how I would been. I'd like to see how they would have covered that show.
Yeah.
Because of the controversy there, like everybody figures, you know, Sergio should have won that show. Even Arnold said if he would have was a judge, he would have picked Sergio
right.
for that show. But you know, like I said, just was. I think there's only five competitors in the whole show
yeah.
over in Germany.
But, did Mike Katz beat Ken Waller at that Mr. World in 1972?
Yes, he did. I believe that's
yeah.
where he did beat he beat Ken Waller.
Yeah, that's interesting. So then Mike Katz and Ed Corney go off to the Mr. Universe. So then they made plans to go to Baghdad, Iraq, to
yeah.
cover that Mr. Universe. And then that
yeah,
was part of the book Pumping Iron.
Yeah, and Ed Corney had won that Mr. Universe show. Yeah, and
right.
then the second part of the book was the 1973 Mr. Olympia at the Brooklyn Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it was too bad the incident in Tijuana where Mr. International, where Sergio clashed with Joe Weider, and then basically he was banned from the IFBB, so he didn't compete that year. So otherwise he would have been there in New York against Arnold in 1973. Wayne D'Amelio was there, and that's the first time he saw Arnold compete. Wayne was quite young. He just come to work with Tom Minichiello.
Mm-hmm.
That was the show where Dan Lurie and Tom Minichiello clashed with dates. They both had their shows. Dan had booked Steve Reeves as a guest poser, and he had a lot of great as a guest speaker. And he had a lot of great guest posers, you know, showing up Sergio and I think Boyer Co. And then, you know, then Tom Minichiello had his Mr. Olympia, Mr. America, with I think Lou Ferrigno won the Mr. America that year before he
yeah.
bolted from the WBBG over to the IFBB. And because Wayne was working with Tom Minichiello, he wanted to go see both shows, but they held on the same day. You know, you had to choose. So he went to the Brooklyn Academy, watched Mr. Olympia. But that's the first time he saw Arnold. And he said he was just amazed at Arnold
yeah.
when he saw him. And so those two contests, the 72 Mr. Universe and the 73 Mr. Olympia, constituted the book Pumping Iron that was published in November of 1974.
So did Charles Gaines and George, well, particularly George Butler, because he was the one behind the movie. But was it because of Arnold, after meeting Arnold in 1972 and then covering him in 1973 for the book, was that the impetus for doing the movie?
Yeah, when they first met him, they thought he had the potential and stuff, but they didn't really think much more of that. But as they got to know Arnold, and with the success of the book has some pretty good coverage, that
mm-hmm.
George wanted to take it into a movie, where Charles kind of backed away. I think he surrendered the title rights to George, and Charles narrated it. That was Charles who narrated the movie.
Yeah.
But he didn't take as big a role, and it was mostly George who was going to take all the, like I said in the book, the career haymakers in the chin from doing the movie. He took loans. I think the book came out in 74. By 75, April 75, he thought he'd do a sample film. He
mm-hmm.
borrowed $30,000 and he went back up to Holyoke, Massachusetts, and did a little sample film with Arnold. And he aired it, filmed, you know, in front of a small private audience. And he was just ridiculed. And like George said, he told me, he was close to tears. His wife just hugged him and said, "I've never felt so bad for somebody in my life."
Right.
So like, I'm thinking these are two very intelligent, articulate guys putting
mm-hmm.
it all on the line for bodybuilding. And they're taking a beating. They're taking like a professional and an emotional beating. Charles Gaines, I said, "Charles, did it bother you? Like, that you guys could have gone off and done anything else and been successful?"
Right.
He said that he got used to it. You know, he just got used to it, just ignoring it. George had to do that too, because he was just running into brick walls, especially the gay stigma to it at that time. You know, every way they turned, it was the homosexual thing again, right?
Mm-hmm.
See, George's old lady friend said, "Oh, George, I didn't know you're gay." You know, just because he was doing a movie on bodybuilding, he just automatically
right.
makes him gay. It was ridiculous. So he had to, like, he still plowed on in 70, like I said, April of 75. He kept moving on. But at the same time, Bob Raffleson, director, somebody had sent him a copy of Charles Gaines' Stay Hungry novel.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked it. And so he wanted to make that into a movie. So they were starting to shoot for Stay Hungry in April 1975. Where George Butler is going to start shooting a lot of the same bodybuilders. If you've no doubt seen both movies, correct? So you'll see the same bodybuilders were in both movies. They're trained for Stay Hungry. Like Ken Waller had a pretty good part in Stay Hungry.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny that only in bodybuilding and in Hollywood, they wanted Arnold to come down to 210 pounds. He was still too big to play a bodybuilder. Crazy, right? A bodybuilder was too big to play a bodybuilder. So Waller looked pretty good in that show. But so they just kept training right after Stay Hungry, right into their countdown training for Mr. Olympia through the summer of 1975. So they had that overlapping filming and training for those two movies.
Yeah.
I was going to mention another thing, too, was kind of funny. With the book, Doubleday gave George and Charles the down payment to go do the book, but when they came back with the manuscript, they demanded their money back. That's like the walls they're running into. It was Simon and Schuster that came through for the publishing of the book. But
yeah, I was going to mention that, too, because you were talking about the movie and the problems they were having, but they also had problems with the book, and then the book ended up being a big success, right, when it was finally released.
Yeah, I think over the years they sold over 800,000 copies.
Yeah.
I think we were talking about the both movies, Stay Hungry and Pumping Iron. They were overlapping in their filming going through the summer. You know, they're filming a lot of the book. With George, he went over to Sardinia for a couple of weeks to film Franco's family up in the mountains there. They film all across the United States, and they were getting quite a bit of footage on the different bodybuilders depending on the outcome. But I kind of sarcastically in the book said they could have probably just asked Joe and saved a lot of filming of what the outcome was going to be. But I think this is the whole thing about Pumping Iron. The only guy they didn't get much film footage of was Serge Debray, and that's a big issue. With the movie, like, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that went on in Pretoria, and
hey, Randy,
I don't blame.
Get into that, was one of the reasons that Charles Gaines wasn't so involved with the movie Pumping Iron was because they were filming Stay Hungry around that same time that George was getting ready to start filming Pumping Iron.
He never said exactly. He never gave me that as a reason why. Because Stay Hungry, that didn't come along, I think, until like the spring, 1975, and it was around the time George was going to. Charles is more wrapped up with. He's probably spending more time with George on Pumping Iron because Ralphson took the novel, the Stay Hungry novel, and was going to go from that script, right? But Arnold was crisscrossing because he played Joe Santos in Stay Hungry. And I'm not sure how long they filmed. I know they started in April. I don't know how many months that they filmed.
One thing I didn't know reading your book, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, was that the book Stay Hungry was a finalist for the National Book Awards in 1972. I didn't know that was such a well-received book.
Yeah, Charles is a good writer. Like when he was asked to write the Sports Illustrated article, I think he was an assistant professor at one of the universities at the time or colleges at the time. Like he had a master's in creative writing. So like I said, both these guys are very talented.
Writer.
Yeah, they're very good. I enjoyed his writing even in Pumping Iron and stuff. And
me too.
And I quote him quite a bit, especially even with the women. I thought he had good insight. Even like he judged, like there was issues of some raised eyebrows that he judged at the 1975 Mr. Olympia, but he had judged earlier in 1974. But he was probably more qualified as the judge than most of the people that graced the IFBB judging panels over the years, because he was kind of like a throwback to the Eugene Sandow and the Bernard McFadden days, where they wanted artists and men of science and stuff who knew anatomy and symmetry to look at it from that perspective, and that's how Charles did it. And, you know, I don't think there was any big problems. Like I said, he showed good judgment in 1980 when he Arnold asked him to come to Australia, and he said no. And I asked him, why did you say no? He said, because I knew he was going to ask me to judge, and he goes, he didn't want to be part of that
no.
one. Because he wasn't sure Arnold could win. 75 was pretty sure that Arnold was going to win because then nobody else was allowed in. But in 1980, he said he wasn't sure Arnold could win. He didn't want to get caught up in that. So I thought it was good. Arnold and Maria were very angry with him for a long time. But he made, I think he made the right decision. But, you know, so like I said, he judged. I think he judged in 1976 Miss Olympia as well.
But he was at the 1975 Mr. Olympia, right? He was there.
Oh yeah, he was there. Yeah. Like he judged it. He was one of the judges. He judged 74. He judged 75. He judged in 76.
Okay.
Mr. Olympia he judged. Like I said, a lot of people would be. If you're looking at the movie Pumping Iron, most people didn't know Arnold retired up to 74. George Butler had to entice him out with. George wouldn't give me the mount. Jerome Gary, who was a co-produced with George. He told me they offered Arnold $50,000 and I think 5% of the cut of the film to get him to compete again. So if most of the competitors, if any of the competitors knew at that time that Arnold's being paid $50,000 to compete and George and then Charles Gaines is going to judge the contest, you know, a lot of them are going to say, what the hell, right? But Charles is pretty straight up. I think Charles is straight up with his judging, but there was other shenanigans going on, I think, with Serge Nubre, and that we can talk about in a bit if you want, when it came down to the contest time. But, you know, George had his storylines that he wanted. And even in book one of volume three, I talked about another situation that happened in Pretoria with Danny Padilla, where him and Mike Katz, there was four of them sent over to the Mr. Universe show. We can only send three, a lightweight, a middleweight, and a heavyweight. So that was another issue that I believe was settled with George Butler. Because Danny was ousted, and which didn't make any sense. Because I'm quite sure if Ben would have had his way, He would have liked to have Danny in, so the United States could have swept the light. I can't remember if they went tall or weight by or tall class at that time. They would have got the short, medium, and the tall class.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, neither Mike or Ken Waller had won a contest since 1974 or 73.
Because that year, Danny won the Mr. USA in 75, and Robbie Robinson won the Mr. World, so they were automatically on the team.
That's right.
And then and the only reason both Ken Waller and Mike Katz went over is because of the movie, right?
I think so. Because the tall guys who won the USA and America that year lost overall to Danny and Robbie. So you couldn't say they were the outstanding guys. I understand. Mike and Ken were world renowned or internationally known huge bodybuilders. At that day, they were the big guys, right? People wanted to see them. I can understand that. But another reason I think Danny got bumped is because over there, they were going to, Ed Jubenville was going to make Mike Katz and Ken Waller pose down. And the loser, because they're both of them were Mr. World winners, they were eligible to compete in Olympia. That's why Mike Katz competed in the Mr. Olympia the next year in 76. But none of them had trained, and none of them wanted to go against Arnold. They trained for the Mr. Universe, and they did not train to go against Arnold. And George Butler did not shoot any footage. He shot their footage of those guys to compete in the Universe, not against Arnold. George had his storyline with Lou and Arnold. So I asked Charles, George is not well these days, so I asked Charles, is this a possibility? He goes, it certainly was a possibility. He said, he goes, I can't say if that happened, but he said he would not be surprised if George had a say in that. So they just said to Danny, you know, you're 24, you're going to have your day in the sun. Step down, and they let both Mike and Ken compete as the two heavyweights, the two tall guys, right?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that story, but Danny really got screwed that year.
Oh, totally. Yeah. He can be a heartbroken, right? And, you know, Mike Katz, he encouraged me. He had no, he didn't know what was going on either, even to this time. He,
oh, really?
He,
okay.
He wanted me to pursue it, to find out why, what happened, because he said he was told he was going to compete. So he wasn't trying to weasel his way in on anything.
Right.
He was told that he's going to compete, and so was Danny. So they had this little quagmire thing going there, and then it had to be resolved over there last minute, and Danny got bumped out. And, you know, that's, like I said, there was a lot of things going on behind.
Do you think George wanted Mike in the movie because he was in the book and he liked him personally?
Absolutely. He liked him personally, and he was in, and he got a lot of film on him. He had a good storyline with Mike and wanted him in the in the movie. So, and, you know, the
I think Mike Katz in the movie was sort of the everyman that, you know, everybody could relate to. He was picked on when he was younger and, you know.
Yeah.
The underdog, and he was coming back, right? Remember he said in the movie that he came back like four times to try and win Mr. Universe, and
fantastic athlete too.
Yeah,
like I remember listening to him on your show. I think it was your show where he said he ran a 4.6 in his full gear on grass and went back with the Jets.
Yeah,
was that on
and
your show?
And as a bodybuilder, people don't remember how big he was. You know, when he came out and he was posing, he was like so huge. Compared to most of the bodybuilders back then.
Bill Kosiba, he's in Florida, gym owner. He was telling me how big Mike was, and he's seen a lot of people. But in person, he said Mike is just a huge guy, huge guy.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. George wanted him in competing in the Mr. Universe, and that's where he had planned. That's where the storylines were. That's where the film all took place. So that's probably why that happened.
And one thing I wanted to go back to talking to you about, Randy, is when you said that George Butler went to where Arnold was filming Stay Hungry, and he asked him to be in the movie because at this point, like you said, Arnold was already retired. He retired in 74, and he said he had to be in the movie, but he had to compete in order to be in the movie, and then they offered him $50,000 to be in the movie, which is a lot of money back in 1975, plus 5%, I think you said, of the net that the movie would be.
Yeah. I've heard other numbers too, even more, but I don't think it'd be more. $50,000, as you said, in 1975 was a lot of money in bodybuilding, way more than, because I know even Dan Lurie offering Sergio and Arnold for $5,000 to come compete in his 1974 pro show was a lot of money at the time. So $50,000 was enormous. He's definitely going to draw Arnold out, and this is the whole thing. Did he pay Arnold $50,000 to come back? Certainly not to lose. He was the main storyline. Why? You know, the guy I always said who should have been in Pumping Iron, it was Sergio.
Yeah.
You know, for the movie, the guy was colorful. He was huge. Mm-hmm. He was always in an antagonist to Arnold. He's Arnold's peer. You know, like, I mean, he beat Arnold before.
Mm-hmm.
But Charles said that any talk of Sergio at that time was met with a negative reaction. They just did not want Sergio in there. At least Ben and those guys didn't. So it was, you know, they only had Lou and Arnold in the tall class. And, well, Sergio had always, I mean, Serge had been planning to come. But like I said, there's three different versions of what happened with Serge Nubre.
Yeah, I want to talk about that also, but that is a shame that Sergio was not, I mean, it's kind of weird that Sergio was sort of out of both the book and the movie, because his last time he competed with Arnold was in 72, and then in 73 they had that Tijuana incident at the Mr. International where Sergio challenged Arnold, and then after that he was out, and then he didn't go to the Olympia that year, which was only a couple of weeks after that show. And then that was the one where it was covered in the book, Pumping Iron. So if Sergio would have been in that Mr. Olympia, then he definitely would have been covered in the book.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure if he – I don't think he was banned yet, but I think the point was Sergio knew he got screwed in Tijuana.
Yeah.
He's going to get screwed in Brooklyn. So he said, what the hell, why go there? Because he was getting better coverage and winning in NABA. And I don't – Sergio only – I'm not sure. I think he only competed in the one NABA show. He was getting better coverage with Dan and his WBBG.
Right.
At that time and stuff. But, yeah, it's a missed opportunity. But, you know, again, we see that often with the weeders, they don't care about that. It's always something else that takes priority over giving the audience what they really want to see.
Yeah, it's a shame that Sergio and Arnold didn't compete more often. They only competed like four times, right? 69 and twice in 70 and then 72.
Yeah. Yeah, in 72. And it should have probably been a split because Sergio should have probably won in 72.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about some other guys that could have been in the movie or could have been in the contest and never were. One which I didn't know until I read your book was Steve Mihalik, who was actually training with Lou Ferrigno that year. And then I guess Lou's father, Matty, sort of came along and took over the training with Lou. And then Steve was kind of out of it, right?
Yeah, Steve thought that was the downfall for Lou to go train with his dad. And I agree. Like, I mean, Mihalik was an animal.
Yeah.
Lou probably would have benefited from training with Steve more.
Yeah.
And like, that whole slant with Lou and his dad. But Steve said he was going to, that Arnold had contacted him, come to move to California. He's going to hook him up with a roommate with Roger Callard and come compete in the Olympia. But he was training to go compete in the NABBA universe in the fall. It's not likely he would have been allowed to compete in the Olympia because everybody, even Sergio, Frank Zane, Dennis Tinarino won the Pro Mr. Universe in the summer of 75 that Franco put on, won $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
He would be the odds-on challenger. And he got disqualified and banned from going because of a show he competed in. I couldn't find any other than 2 years earlier. It might have been more that his escort service might have got him to boot out. But mm-hmm. Dennis was a very articulate guy and smart guy.
Right.
And
right.
He would have been a great interview and a great guy to have in the show. But he was out. They got rid of him, too.
Yeah.
So and Mihalik, he's a good speaker. Like Jerome Gary said, he found Steve very intelligent. But he said he never saw him with his sweats off. So he didn't know that Steve was planning to come in very big, you know, 220 so, but he had that very small waist, right?
Mm-hmm.
These guys all would have added lots of color to it. But they're, like I said, Steve got hit by a dump truck anyways. He couldn't do it. But I don't think he would have been allowed because he competed in the NABBA. He probably would have been disqualified for competing. But like I said, with Dennis and Sergio, you know, these were good guys that have been really added to the mix, but they weren't in the show. And then Serge Nibre was almost not in the show either.
Yeah.
So they
what
would
was
have
the
said
timeline with Steve Mihalik then? He was training with Lou Ferrigno, and yeah. Then Lou Ferrigno's... Now, was it the producers of Pumping Iron that said, let's bring in Lou's dad, Matty, and then have him like as the coach? And then Steve was kind of out? Was that the way it went?
I don't know exactly why that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it happened. Like Matty came in, and like both of them were training at R&J and at this other more hardcore gym. But once Matt Ferrigno came in, that they all the training switched primarily over to Julie Levine's R&J gym. So
mm-hmm.
And that's when they just, you know, like I said, Lou said that him and his dad had never trained together before. His dad never trained them, and when they were done, Matt Ferrigno just said he never wanted to go to the gym with him again. It was a very sad story between Lou
yeah.
and his father.
Right.
I had no idea that that's what was going on behind the scene. Like I had mixed feelings with Lou's book in 1994. I thought, you know, was it a good thing to air that out in front of everybody? But at the same time, you feel like, wow, that's, you know, it was a tough relationship, but nobody watching the movie would have any idea. Like I said, Pumping Iron was a docudrama. Like it wasn't sheer documentary. It was a lot, obviously, drama put in there, even with Waller and Mike Katz with the T-shirt that was put in afterwards. And
right.
Like Mike told you, he wasn't happy with that. Because it made him look like a wimp. He's a guy, he said he was facing 300-pound linemen. He said he was hardly
right.
worried what's going to worry him about somebody taking his T-shirt, which made total sense, right?
Right, right.
So, but, you know, I had no idea. I had no idea that. I had heard an interview, too, way back where Ken Waller said, look, there's no animosity. He goes, Mike Cass is my friend, always will be my friend. He goes,
right.
Because Waller got heckled a few times afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody thought he stole poor Mike's shirt.
I was at the 1977 Mr. Olympia in Columbus, the year the movie came out. Everybody,
you were there. You were there, weren't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because didn't you go to the 77, 78, and the 79 Olympias?
Yeah, I saw all the three that Frank Zane won.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that you were as a kid you were able to catch the World's Strongest Man, catch Lou and Franco at the was it CBS lot there?
That was amazing. That was Universal Studios. For those that don't know the story, I was on vacation with my family and I was only 14 years old, and we were in Southern California because we were traveling all the way out west by car. It was like a 4-week trip, and when we were in California, I wanted to go to Gold's Gym because I was already into bodybuilding and reading the magazines. And we didn't have time because we were on this strict schedule. You know, we had to go someplace every day in order to cover everything we wanted to cover. So we were going to Universal Studios one day, and it just so happened to be that was the day that they were filming the World's Strongest Man contest for television. And Franco and Lou Ferrigno were in the show, and Arnold was there to see them, to watch them. So in one day, just by chance, I got to meet the three greatest bodybuilders in the world, Arnold, Franco, and Lou Ferrigno. So that was a crazy twist of fate, you know?
That was a great story. That's why I put it in the Volume 3, Book 1. I thought, this is unreal. Like, this is great stuff.
Yeah.
There's this young kid off to Mr. Olympia three times in a row. You're not even 20 years old. You're going to the Mr. Olympia. Then you're running into these three guys in 1977 with shooting that show. You must have, like I said... I thought the irony was that you it could have been just hours or even a day or so, you saw Franco before he tore his knee all up.
Yeah, it had to be, I don't know when it was, but it had to be the next day or two because they were filming that every day. And the one I saw, they were pulling these tram cars. They were sort of like had a harness around them and they were just pulling the tram cars. But yeah, the refrigerator race must have been the next day and I must have just missed that.
And so the next time you see him would be 1981. You're sitting third row or so in his comeback. So that was the great irony there. But we got off on a tangent there. What were we talking about before we...
Steve Mihalik, I was asking about him because he was training with Lou Ferrigno, and then he went into the NABBA Universe, right, that year.
He won his class.
He won his class. Okay.
Yeah, he didn't win the overall. I think Boyer Coe won the overall. You know who else competed in that one that year? Chet Yorton.
Oh, really? Yeah, you're right.
I believe it was Chet Yorton in 75 competed, not 75 or 76, and he lost to Boyer.
Mm-hmm.
But Yorton, that was Yorton's only other contest, I think, other than when he beat Arnold in 1966.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Boyer, by 76, he was into the IFBB, so he was out.
That was the transition. That was the year, I thought, because that's when Arnold and Lorimer hooked up and were going to promote the first Mr. Olympia together in Columbus, and they convinced Boyer to come over. I thought that was the transition when the IFBB Mr. Olympia was starting to take the prestige away from the NABBA universe.
Yeah, after Arnold retired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the Olympia before that just wasn't like. Look at even in '75 Pretoria, right up until the last minute, it was just Arnold and Lou in the tall class, right? Until Serge came in and make it three, and I think there's only five.
Let's talk about Serge Nubret. What happened with him? Now, a lot of people that may not know this who just saw the movie, but Serge was the senior vice president, right, with the IFBB for many years.
Yeah, he was a vice president. I think coming in 1970, but he was just a year before at the 74 Congress election year, he was made senior vice president. And there's in the book, there's like three renditions of what happened to Serge. Serge was not a last minute entry. Mm-hmm. He was, in a sense, he was being re-entered at the last minute.
Okay.
And according, Rick Wayne's version in Muscle Wars is a little bit funky. And I don't think accurate. Rick wasn't there. Like, he just got his story. But he wrote and he suggests that Serge is going there to challenge Ben for his presidency. But that wasn't election. It was not election year.
How often did they hold that election, Brandon?
Every 4 years.
Every
74, and the next one was 78.
Okay.
Serge did have all the tools to upset Ben in a fair race, but Ben was locking up his presidency for life by putting all the national affiliates ahead of the Weider products in their country, right? So he's basically becoming their employer as well. So he was cementing he was never going to get voted out because they're not going to vote their boss out.
Did Serge run against Ben Weider in 1970 also? I think Roger Walker told me that story.
I've not heard that. that he was made vice president in 70, but
okay.
At that point, that with Oscar State and everything, it was easily, I think Ben was easily, he made the IFBB, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar State basically structured the IFBB. Ben was running a name for a number of years, but I think Ben won easily in 1970. But and in 74, they never talked about really any opposition. And even when Wayne DeMille described how it worked in 1978, it was a joke. Eh? Nobody, like he said, nobody's going to run against their boss. But Serge, you know, Rick Wayne thought that Serge was going to threaten to pull out and take the black bodybuilders with him, that they're going to try to embarrass him. And then they found out that it was Serge who got the IFBB to compete in Pretoria in the first place, and then they're about his movies. But like Ken Sprague said, there's no way the movies should have been an issue with Ben Weider. Like Ben wrote in Brothers of Iron that Serge had been doing pornos, but he wasn't doing pornos. They were like more adult films, and Ben knew about it. Like Ken Sprague said, Ben knew about Ken in 1975, and Ken had told Ben about some of his athletes doing Colt studio photos. So,
let me go back first. I mean, when the contest was going to be in Pretoria, South Africa, there was some controversy over that, right? Because it was an apartheid country where they were very racist against blacks. It wouldn't allow the. And then didn't Ben Weider send Serge Nubre to South Africa to sort of talk to the president or talk to whoever was in charge of bodybuilding in South Africa, just to make sure that it would be okay?
In Brothers of Iron, that's Ben and Joe's book that was put out in 2006.
Right.
There's no mention of that. Ben talks about meeting with, you know, talks had begun in 1973 with Pete Cornoff, the minister of sport.
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, because South Africa had just been brought into the IFBB. Now, when you read Ben's book, there's actually even an article back, I think, in the 1940s, late 40s magazine, that when Ben did this grand tour, he said that South Africa was one of the first of two countries to come into the IFBB back in 1947. So what happened to apartheid started in 48, whatever happened to South Africa over those years, they were brought back in. Now, Serge Nubre said they discussed bringing them in 1972, but it was voted down. Ben doesn't mention that. But 1970, now that's when Ben had Serge Nubre go to South Africa and look at the situation where, and Serge went there and made sure certain conditions were going to be met, that they would have a black president and they were going to, you know, judge fairly, treat everybody equally.
Mm-hmm.
And then Serge was happy. He's okay. He said, no, they're, it's good. So in 1973, they were voted in, but the question is, they were brought into the IFBB, but how did they get the world championships already assigned to them for 1975 back then? That was the big question, and Rick Wayne said that what was speaking there was several hundred thousand dollars that the South Africa offered the Weeders a couple hundred grand, which, like I said, was a ransom at that time. So they basically bought the world championships for 1975, if that is true, and it probably is true, right? So
there, wasn't South Africa banned from the Olympics?
Oh, yeah, they were, you know, the UN had sanctions against them, the Olympics were against them, so Ben usually landed on his feet, like even in the 72, going into Baghdad, Iraq, he was Jewish, and he was at first told he can't come, he's got to send somebody else, and Ben said, no, if you're going to deal with the IFBB, you're going to deal with me, so he was allowed to, but couldn't fly into Israel. You know, Mike Katz was worried about it. It was only a couple of weeks earlier that the 11 Israeli athletes were shot in Munich at the 72 Olympic Games.
Right.
So it was a political hotbed over there. And but Ben pulled it off. It was well done, and everybody. Mike Katz was treated like a god over there.
Yeah.
They didn't care. Like I said, you know, all this political crap. It's amazing how it all disappears when you have commonality, right? There's those guys. Mike Katz, a bodybuilder. They don't care he's Jewish. He's a bodybuilder, right? They like what they're doing. So I found that was quite interesting. And then Ben goes from Iraq. Then he jumps into apartheid, right, in the South Africa, right, from the frying pan into the fire.
Right.
But he pulled it off. Butler and Gaines were pretty smart. to basically avoid the politics. I gave Kit Laughlin in book one of volume three the same latitude, where he didn't cover a lot of the politics that were going on there, because just how do you do it, right, without getting without destroying the film? Like, even with the movie Pumping Iron, there was no talk of steroids, where the book did. But to their defense, how do you deal with it? I thought the challenge for George and Charles in the movie was enough just to define what bodybuilding was to the people, let alone how to, and here's steroids and all that stuff. They were probably smart to leave that out, but they also left out the politics that were going on behind the scenes. And I think I think George Butler may have had a say, because I don't believe Rick Wayne's rendition is accurate. Ben's rendition is that he told Serge a couple weeks ago he can't compete because he was involved in these films. And
do you think that Ben Weider wanted Serge Nubre out? And if so, why? Why was Serge all of a sudden on the, you know?
That's why Ben's rendition doesn't make any sense. Now, what the other side, Serge Nubre's side, is that Serge, and there's another person I spoke to who wanted to remain anonymous, that said Serge had been approached by Ben Weider. Apparently, you got to remember, Serge Nubre was a very smart guy, and he was ahead of most people when it came to drugs at that time. He had a lot of money backing him with Paco Ars. Paco was basically, Serge basically pimped for him. Paco would walk around with a satchel full of cash, soliciting the bodybuilders, but he had a lot of money. And so Serge basically got what he wanted. And he was pretty advanced in steroid use at that time. And he was in apparently incredible condition. He wasn't going there to go after Ben Weider's presidency. He wanted to win the Olympia. He was a bodybuilder, and he wanted to win. And he was like 212 pounds, he said. And my source said that Serge told them that Ben approached Serge and asked him to drop out because if he dropped out, he would make sure he got all the fairness and all the promotion for next year's Olympia. In fact, it almost guaranteed him a win. Okay, so why did they want him to drop out? Is he in such good condition that, okay, remember what we were talking about? Charles and George hardly have any footage of him at all. So you got all this storyline of Arnold and Lou, and all of a sudden in comes this other guy and wins, you know, and they're paying Arnold $50,000 to come back. That's not what they want. So I wouldn't be surprised if George had something to do with that, because George kind of skirted these questions about, he says they didn't film Serge strictly from economics. Jerome Gary said they did get some footage of him. They said there were three different versions of the story.
Yeah,
that Serge wanted money.
They went to Paris for 3 days, right? And they offered him like $1,000, but he wanted film
rights in France. Yeah. But Jerome Gary said they did catch some footage of him, but again, none of it was shown in the movie. So you can't. To me, it was like, okay. Nobody was going to mow Arnold down. Arnold was in good shape.
Yeah.
But Serge was in fantastic shape, and he was possibly a threat. So Serge said that he was devastated the 2 weeks out, and he didn't do anything. He lost 12 pounds, and he said it was visible on him, and then Ben let him in at the last minute. What the truth is exactly, I don't know. But I think there's some rationale there, because there's no other reason why that should have happened. Because, like I said, he wasn't there. There wasn't an election year. The films weren't, you know, they could not have been that big a deal, because Ben knew all about everybody's films, you know, not just Serge's. And Serge was, there's that photo in there. He did look very incredible. Serge from angles, it looks like Mr. Olympia. But from when he would, I remember when I could see still, when he was head on, he wasn't as impressive.
Yeah,
when he was faced straight on the camera, where Arnold was incredible facing the camera. Like, he just exploded with his front double biceps and stuff. Like I said, nobody was, even if Sergio there in shape and Arnold's shape, it would have been a good show. Like, I mean, Arnold, you could tell that Lou was not in condition like Arnold was in 75. Right. You could see the differences. And like I said, Charles didn't really have any issues scoring the show. You know, the overall title, to me, Franco never was a Mr. Olymp. I liked Franco. I was always a fan of his because he was a strong guy and powerlifting and stuff and his bodybuilding. But he just, to me, didn't have the aesthetics of a Mr. Olympia. I always thought like his arms didn't match his torso and stuff like that. So, I mean, he's not going to beat Arnold. You know,
so when it comes to Sergeant Gray, Randy, what do you think happened? Do you think that he was looking so good that Ben Weider was actually afraid that he might beat Arnold, or do you think?
Yeah, I think he was a potential threat. I think he was a threat to beat Arnold, or make it too close for comfort if they're going to judge. But usually, you know, they can sway the judging whichever they want to go. But the other ones just don't make any sense, because if it was the films, if it really was the films that pissed Ben off, why did he let him in at the end? Why did he let him in?
Yeah.
Because he only had two competitors, he just wouldn't have let him in. But right. I mean, I think it's not that Serge was guaranteed to beat Arnold, but I just think they just didn't want it to be that close. I think everything was riding the money, the film, everything on Arnold's victory. And Ben and Joe always wanted Arnold like down in Tijuana when Rick Wayne was having dinner with Eddie Silvestre and. Joe Weider, he clearly said he's got too much invested in Arnold to let him lose.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought in his own judges down there. That's why Sylvester ran the WBG banner the next year at his Mr. International, because the IFBB was out. So,
right. So that was
in
73, so it seemed like it was political back then. Weider was trying to, supposedly Weider was trying to sway the judging panel, but by 75, do you think it was pretty much judged fairly and that, you know, Arnold might have had a chance to lose if Serge Dubre would have came in great shape?
I still think the judges would have just went with Arnold anyways. But, I mean, it's just a matter if they didn't want any controversy. Like, that's all I can think of. Like, I don't know for certain. But, I mean, the other things don't make sense. You know, Serge, did compete, and he was allowed back in. Where it was with Rick Wayne's version, Rick Wayne had him threatening to pull out. Well, he was already out. He was just being allowed back in. And like I said, if my source is, I believe my source, but if it's a matter with Serge is being honest with my source, that Ben approached him and asked him to drop out just to make things easier. They just didn't want to, it was like too much riding on it. We just wanted to go smoothly. We don't want any threats. And Serge, he said the rumors were out that he was 212, ripped to the bone. And like I said, he seemed to be ahead of the rest of the crowd in many ways in drug use. And so it wouldn't be surprised if he found some type of combination that got him pretty big, you know, bigger than normal or the best shape that he had ever been in anyways. So,
well, it's interesting too that even though Serge was the senior vice president for the IFBB, and he promoted the 71 Olympia, he was actually allowed to compete in the Olympia in 72 and 73. And, he's pretty much judged fairly. They didn't give him any favoritism, because he was, even though he was the vice president, I think he got third in 73 to Arnold and Franco. And then he also lost in 72 to Arnold and Sergio.
Yeah, I know. He had lost to these guys before. Like, I mean, everybody competing there had lost to... had lost Arnold, but that particular year he was supposed to be at his all-time best. The 71 was bizarre as well with how they would not let Franco compete in the Mr. Universe because of the Mr. World the year before. They wouldn't let Arnold compete in the NABBA, and then they wouldn't let Sergio compete in the IFBB, but they let Albert Beckles compete in both. Wayne DeMayo said to me, he goes, don't try to figure it out, Randy. It's like they make the rules as they go. Whatever facilitates business. Like I was asked this question on a show, radio show, I think one of Carl Lenore's shows, that was Joe Pure, if he had his choice, would he want to be Mr. Olympia, or would he want to be the best publisher business? And like Boyer, my boy's a good friend, he said he thinks Joe would have wanted to be Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know, listening to Wayne D'Amelio for 10, 12 years we've been talking, and Wayne has nothing personal against either of the Weeders. He's banged head with them, but he has good stories, bad stories. He said to him it was clear, very clear. Yes, Joe loved bodybuilding, but he loved business better. Business always trumped the sport. He like Wayne would say, Joe, why do you want me to do this? Do you realize what you're asking me to do is hurts the sport? Oh, you know, all they do is impression, you know, Joe Weider. But it looked good on the cover, Wayne. You know, you do is Joe Weider impression. That's the way Joe, he loved publishing. He really did love publishing. And Wayne was convinced that bodybuilding took a second seat. So they would do. They seemed to do. Look, if Serge was telling the truth in his manuscript about what Ben was making him, they were willing to relegate Arnold to just a trophy bearer. Serge said that Ben and Joe wanted him to compete against Bill Pearl because he believed they could beat him.
Right.
But Serge said, no, our rules say he can't. If we're going to be a serious organization, they just ratified their organization and their Congress and their constitution the year before in Yugoslavia to make the IBB a legitimate federation. Now they're just going to blow and throw the rules out the window. And Serge was actually trying to hold the fort in terms of running the federation like a real sporting federation with Oscar State, right?
Plus, Serge was also promoting the 71 Olympia, so he had he wanted Arnold to be in it. That's why.
Certainly, yeah. And then, but there's Albert Beckles, who was allowed to compete in both. And I asked Wayne Galosh, because Wayne was there at the time, he said because they were challenging NABBA. Albert Beckles was a great athlete. They needed him on the team with the IFBB team challenging NABBA in England. So they let him do it.
Yeah, he brought over a big team, right, to compete at the IFBB Universe.
Yeah, and all these little politics. Look at all the bannings that went on in those early 70s, people getting, you know, they kept good athletes out and they kept the audience from seeing great competitions. Going up to just to put Dan Leary out of business, they make sure they held their Olympia on the same day Dan held their show in 73. They don't care. They kept Sergio out of the show, you know, so people can't see these events. Keep them out again in 75. That's just the way bodybuilding was back then.
When they were filming Pumping Iron, I'm sure nobody expected it, you know, to be the landmark film that it was. And now 40 years later, it's still an iconic film for sure for all the bodybuilders, even the new generation who don't even probably know who most of these bodybuilders were. But when they were filming it, I'm sure they had no idea. And then even after they got done filming it, they didn't have the money, right, to release it because it was done filming in 75. So it really should have been released in 76, but they weren't able to release it until January of 77.
Yeah, Cinema 5 got the distribution rights, and still, the way it was distributed, they distributed it differently at the time. It never, you know, I heard about it, and I wanted to see it, but, I mean, I didn't get to see it till later, but...
I saw it in the theater when it came out in 77, but it was like a small art house theater downtown Chicago, and there was like five people in the theater.
Yeah, it became more popular. The book is very popular, and the movie within the field was popular. I still credit Charles Gaines. Like, the bodybuilding was coming to public, to bear in public in the 1970s. I think Charles Gaines, George Butler, Schwarzenegger, Arthur Jones, Ken Sprague, later in the Stecky Wayne D'Amelio, and Frank Zane all made the sport that decade. You know, because, you know, George and Charles, even the Whitley Museum, like, these guys were taking bodybuilding, trying to give it credibility. They're taking it out of the circus thing because Joe and Ben had bodybuilding corralled up in this cartoon caricature. Bombing, blitzing, get all the women hanging off of them. And it hurt the sport. It hurt because it made it look more like a circus. And Butler and Gaines were trying to put out there as an art form. And then when they got Frank and Ed and Schwarzenegger to go in the Whitley Museum, I think in about the spring of 76, these are whole different venues for bodybuilding.
Yeah. What was the reason for that? Was it because George Butler, I remember he said he maxed out all his credit cards getting the film made, you know, and traveling to all the places they traveled to film the movie. So when it came time to release the film, was he just out of money and the Whitney Museum of Art exhibition, that was a way to raise some money for it or raise some awareness?
Yeah, both, because it was a sellout.
Yeah, but they weren't expecting it to be, right?
I'm not sure what they were expecting, but they were how many people would come, but they had a ton of people there, and Corny was still on his cycles. He was probably still looking at, well, Arnold and Frank were substantially smaller.
Yeah, Arnold was really small.
And so Frank was not in condition shape at all. But, you know, it was, like I said, a whole different venue for bodybuilding to be looked at by artists.
Was that George Butler's idea to do it at the Whitney Museum?
Oh, yes, I would think so, him and Charles. Like I said, these guys were from outside the sport. They were breaking the cartoon caricature barriers here. Competitive bodybuilding, it was probably at its zenith, and that's why in Volume 3, Book 1, I said that Arnold and Franco come back after 5 years competing out of their era. Did they derail it temporarily or not? That's the question, right? I'm not saying they did or they didn't. I asked the question, did they derail it? That's why with the cover, I have Franco and Arnold with Frank Zane's image in the background, right? Charles and George were hugely significant for catapulting Arnold, more so than Joe. I think Joe could not have done it, and I'm not sure Arnold could have done it on his own either, because Gaines and Butler, they spent a lot of time with Arnold, and they were like mentored him in a number of ways, and you know, even the bodybuilders as a sculptor, you know, that was Charles Gaines talking about to Arnold, but they were very significant figures in bodybuilding, and they came back to do the women as well in 1983. So, you know, then they Arnold, you know, during those outtakes, Arnold acquired the outtakes in 1991, but very few people saw the 110 hours of footage. There was a lot of stuff on there that Arnold wouldn't have wanted out public. So his language and his behavior. So that's why he picked it up in 1991, and we knew why he made that 25th anniversary. For me, I thought certainly he made the 25th anniversary to try to clean up, try to make excuses, you know, because he's going to run for governor the next year.
Uh-huh.
And he was just clearing the air. I was kind of cynical in Volume 3 as well when I said he reached out to mend fences with Mike Mentzer. I said that he treated Mentzer horribly from some of the things how Arnold had treated Mike horribly. But he reached out in 2001, just before Mike's death, actually. And I said, well, did Arnold have remorse? Or was he concerned that Mike was getting very popular again and getting a big audience, and he wanted to mend the fences? He didn't want any negative detractors. It's smart. It was a smart thing to do, if that was the reason. Or I could be wrong, and maybe, you know, like, but Arnold's Arnold. I still think he was just mending fences because he was getting into politics. He didn't want to deal with any negative stuff coming after him later. But,
yeah,
you know.
Something that you just mentioned there, which I sort of forgot, was all those hours of film they did. You said 110 hours of film. And I remember when Arnold was with that supplement company a couple of years ago, and they would show some unseen footage from Pumping Iron. It was some great jewels of cinema, you know, that they would show, and it would be on public media like Facebook and stuff. And then I guess he cut ties with that supplement company, so all those unseen clips of Pumping Iron sort of stopped. But that would be amazing if he was somehow able to release the footage that at least he wants everybody to see.
Well, he should, yeah. The sound stuff, if he does, he can keep up. But I told Mahalik when he was still alive, I said, you should approach Arnold. Like, Steve would have liked to have seen some of the footage. And he said, well, Arnold has it. There's no reason why, you know, well, he could, this like 110, that's a lot of footage, man.
Yeah. Imagine.
You could put several little documentaries together about these guys, probably a lot of them training, and their stories. Like, George did a lot of storylines. He did a whole storyline on Ed Corny. He did a storyline on Danny Padilla.
Yeah.
Based on how the show was going to turn out. So, I mean, he's got all these storylines that are just sitting there doing nothing, right?
Just the training footage alone. You got to be unbelievable.
Yeah. So I don't know why he doesn't do anything with it. He's got the money. He's got, you know, it'd be a great thing to do. But, you know, it's, I guess nobody's really asked him why he's not doing that.
He'll be 70 years old this year. So why wait?
Yeah, I guess he will be turning 70. Won't
yeah.
He? So that's Franco's got to be what, 75, 76 then?
Yeah, I think he's at least 6 or maybe even 8 years older than Arnold.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that they're at that age at this time, eh? They say, well, time goes by.
Yeah.
We've
yeah.
Passed, like,
well, the 40th anniversary of Pumping Iron is just an amazing, amazing film. And I think, you know, I think when they did do the film, I think they did it right. And they focused on the personalities involved, Arnold and Mike Katz and Lou Ferrigno and Ken Waller and Ed Corney and Franco and all the rest. And then the general public, which had all these preconceived notions of bodybuilding, got to see these bodybuilders as human beings, and especially Arnold, the great personality, and then the rivalry between him and Ferrigno and how he was able to psych him out and all that. And it just became a fascinating movie to people who knew nothing about bodybuilding. And it stood the test of time, you know, 40 years later. Like I said, we got whole new generations of people who are into the sport now, and even people who aren't into the sport, they love that movie. It's like one of the biggest documentaries probably ever, the sports documentaries at least.
I can still sit down and watch it or listen to
yeah.
it. Like I visually seen it, now I listen to it. But
yeah,
I agree. I think George and Charles took the right proper route for the movie. And if you want it more about bodybuilding, even with the drugs, it was in the book.
Yeah.
The Charles dealt with the steroids in the book and stuff, so they didn't really skirt anything. He said it wasn't an easy thing to approach the bodybuilders about either. They didn't want to just right open up to it about it either, right? That topic.
Yeah, and back then too, I don't think the general public really was aware of steroids. I don't think really the public became aware of steroids until the 1988 Olympics when.
Yeah. You know, no, absolutely. You're right. That's like I said. How would they deal with it? Like, why bother? Like, where are you going to go
right,
with it? How are you going to teach? Stay with
right.
the teach them what show them what bodybuilding is, and forget about that. In the book, Charles did deal with it, and so they covered all angles. And it's just a classic. Pumping Iron is a classic. The name is classic,
mm-hmm.
and they did a great job. I really like those guys. I'm really grateful that they gave me the time that they did, and they both gave me a good review of it. So it was, like I said, it's a classic for the sport.
Absolutely. Well, Randy, I want to thank you for joining us. And for those that aren't aware of Muscle Smoke and Mirrors, please look on Amazon, or you have your own website too, Randy, right?
Yeah, randyroach.ca.
Randyroach.ca. Okay. So yeah. They could go there and they could purchase the book directly from you, or, you know, like I said, probably get it on Amazon or wherever, but there's volume 1, volume 2, and volume 3, and it really has some great insights into the background of bodybuilding, some things that are never discussed, and it really has some great interviews with a lot of the people who made the sport what it is. And I want to thank you again for joining us, Randy. It was great to talk to you, great to get a lot of the inside information about the movie Pumping Iron and the book Pumping Iron, and we appreciate you joining us, and I hope you can be a guest on our show again.
Oh, no problem. Thanks, John. Maybe it won't be 7 years.
No, we won't make it 7 years.
Okay. Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank
okay,
you, Randy.
Bye.
All right. That was great. Thanks for Randy Roach for joining us on the first episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Join us next Wednesday when we will be here with Roger Callard. And Roger was one of the real golden age bodybuilders of the 1970s. He was actually a training partner of Arnold Schwarzenegger, so he's got some great stories to tell. He was around during the filming of the movie Pumping Iron. So join us next week for Roger Callard. Thanks to Redcon One, Six Pack Fitness, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for their sponsorships of the show. We will see you guys next week.